back straight. But other than your back being straight, it's good to have your body as relaxed as possible, as free of tension as possible. So if there's any tension anywhere in your body, try to let it go. One way you can do that is imagine that it either evaporates and vanishes in space, or it melts and flows downwards and out of you, and then sinks down into the earth below. So whatever works, try to let the tension go and disappear, leaving your body light, relaxed, and as free of tension as possible. And also try to relax your mind. So what that means is, if there are any thoughts in your mind about the past, which could mean earlier this morning, things that you did or things that happened to you earlier today, or any other time in the past, yesterday, last week, and so on. So leave those thoughts aside for now, put them aside. Do the same with any thoughts of the future, things that you have to do later today, tonight, tomorrow, and so on. So the past is over, it's already happened. And we can't go back and change the past. Sometimes it's helpful to think about the past and learn from it. But it's not helpful to be obsessive and keep thinking about the past again and again, worrying about things or wanting to relive pleasant experiences. So that kind of mental activity isn't helpful, and it interferes with meditation. So when you meditate, it's helpful to try to put the past aside, unless we use it in our meditation, unless it's part of our meditation to learn things. And then the future hasn't yet happened. And we don't really know exactly what will happen. The future is very uncertain. Even if we have plans, we organize things very well, but we can't be completely sure that the plans will actually happen the way we plan. Some other factors could come up, things could change, and our plans get disrupted. So it is useful to think about the future. We do need to think about it and make plans, but again, not too much, not in an obsessive way, thinking again and again and again about the future. And again, in meditation, thinking about the future can be a distraction, distracting our mind away from our meditation. So it's best when we meditate to try to just keep our awareness in the present, in the here and now, right here where we are, and right now in the present moment. And being aware of the breath coming in and going out helps to do that, because our breath is in the present. So when we pay attention to the breath, stay with the breath, observe the breath, naturally our attention is here and now. So do that for a few minutes to settle down your mind, be in the here and now. Okay, so by watching the breath, paying attention to the breath, our mind goes into a neutral state, meaning neither negative nor positive. So as we now move into the main part of the meditation and the session this morning, it's good to try to put our mind into a positive state, a virtuous state, having a virtuous, positive motivation for being here and participating in this session. So if you're familiar with the idea of bodhicitta, the wish to become enlightened to help all living beings, and if you're comfortable with that, you feel that's something you would like to aim for, then you can bring that into your mind and feel the wish, the aspiration that what we're doing here today will help us get closer to enlightenment, Buddhahood, so that we can help all living beings. So you can make that your motivation. But some of you may not be so familiar with that idea or not so comfortable with it. You may have doubts if there's such a thing or if you can achieve it. So that's normal. Often it takes a long time before we really understand bodhicitta and are able to feel comfortable with it. But you might be able to have some other altruistic intention, such as the wish to work on yourself, better yourself, help your mind become more positive, less negative, so that in your relationships and interactions with others, you can be more helpful to them, less likely to hurt them. So if you're comfortable with that, you could have that as your motivation. So you could think something like, by my being here today, may I learn things that will help me be a better person, a more helpful person, able to help others better, able to help the world. So something like that. So feel free to generate whatever positive motivation you're able to, that you're comfortable with. Okay, so let's do a little bit of meditation on the whole idea of transforming problems. So bring to mind a problem that is happening in your life at the present time. So you don't have to think of your biggest problem. That might be too much, too overwhelming. So you could choose a smaller problem. Even if you have some discomfort in your body right now, you might be feeling a little unwell or some ache or pain somewhere in the body. You could use that. Or you could use something that you're concerned about, worried about, unhappy about. So you might have many problems, but just choose one. Choose a relatively minor problem for now and bring that to mind. And when you do bring it to mind, see if you can notice how your mind wants to push it away or to run away from it, to avoid it, because it's so unpleasant. It's something you don't want to be there. And it's actually fine to try to find solutions to our problems. But even if we do, they may not always work. Or they may take a while before they work. So that problem might still be there in our body or mind or life for a while. But we can work on our attitude about the problem and have a more open and positive attitude. And we can even use the problem as part of our spiritual practice, helping us develop qualities such as compassion, humility, renunciation, the determination to be free of suffering. So problems aren't necessarily bad. They can be very useful, very positive, if we just know how to use them in the right way. So let's focus on how a problem can help us have more compassion for others. So think that you're probably not the only person in the world who has a problem like this. Think about other people who have the same problem or a similar problem. There might even be thousands or millions of other people in the world who also have a problem like you do. And some people might have this same problem to an even greater degree than you do. They have an even worse kind of problem than you do. So this can help us have compassion, meaning understanding the suffering of others and wishing that they could be free from their suffering. So that feeling might just arise in you naturally, but if it doesn't, you could just say to yourself some words or phrases like, "Oh, I understand now how other people feel when they have this kind of problem. I know how difficult it is, how painful it is. And wouldn't it be nice if all of them could be free from this suffering? If nobody had to experience this suffering, wouldn't that be wonderful?" So you can use your own words, your own phrases, but that's the general idea. It's just trying to understand that, just like you, other people don't like this kind of problem and would like to be free of it. And then you also wish that they could be free of it. And yesterday I explained a simple kind of practice of tonglen, taking and giving, which we can use with our own problem without having to actually take on the suffering of others. But learning to take on our own suffering. So to do this, you just say to yourself something like, so I have this suffering, I have this problem, and I can't get rid of it right away, but by my experiencing this problem, going through this problem, this suffering, may everyone else, all other people who have this same kind of problem, may they be free. So it's a bit like going through the problem on behalf of others, experiencing the problem so that others could be free of their problem. So it's just something you do mentally, on the mental level. But just try doing that, saying to yourself, I take on this problem for the benefit of others. May all of them be free from this problem, this suffering. Okay, so that gives you an idea of how to do this simple Tonglen practice using a problem that you yourself are experiencing. Another way that I've heard it described or explained is you imagine that the suffering, the problem of others kind of comes into yours. Okay? So let's say you have a headache. So you imagine, or you feel the wish, may all other beings' headaches come into mine. Yeah, so may they be free of their headaches, and may my headache suffice for all of them. And by my experiencing this headache, may everyone else be free of their headache. Okay, so that's another way you can do it. And once you know how to do this, once you get some experience, you can do it, you know, in a couple of minutes. You don't even have to be in a formal meditation session. You can do it just in your daily life, at work, or, you know, anytime, anywhere, just within a minute or two. And you might find, everyone has different experiences, but you might find that your suffering, your problem probably won't get worse, even though you're, you know, imagining others' suffering coming into you, but it probably won't get worse. And in fact, it might even get better. It might even go away. That's my experience. Sometimes the problem goes away. Because the thing is, if you have a problem and then your mind is resisting it, is feeling, oh, I don't like this problem, I hate this problem, I wish it would go away, when is it going to go away, how can I get rid of it? You know, you get kind of all obsessed about it and resisting it, pushing it away and not liking it. So that kind of mental activity, I mean, I think it just happens automatically. We don't deliberately think that way, but it's just the automatic response. But that kind of mental activity probably just makes things worse. You know, more tension, more anxiety. So the problem will probably get worse rather than better. Whereas with this practice, you're not doing that. You're not actively trying to resist it. And instead, you're just kind of relaxing and accepting it with compassion, with a feeling of compassion for others, wishing others to be free of suffering. Compassion is a very positive state of mind. And in the West, in America, for example, scientists, researchers have done a lot of studies on compassion, and they find, yes, it is very beneficial. It's good for our body, it's good for our mind. So when we make an effort to feel compassion, it naturally changes our body and our mind. It puts us into a better state. So then you're in a better state of body and mind, more relaxed, more peaceful, more happy, more positive. So that itself probably changes everything, so that you have less suffering rather than more suffering. But that's for you to try on your own. Yeah, and see if it helps. If it doesn't help, then of course you don't have to do it. If it does make things worse, you don't have to do it. It's up to you. But it is, you know, a useful practice to do. And then from the Buddhist point of view, within the context of Buddhism, or at least Mahayana Buddhism, it's said to be, the practice of Tonglen is said to be a very virtuous practice. So whenever we do it, we create virtue, we create good karma. And it's also a way to purify our bad karma. So it's very efficient. So in one practice, which only takes a minute or less, you can purify bad karma, accumulate good karma, and you might find that your problem decreases rather than increases. So it's very efficient, very practical. And but I just encourage you to try it on your own and see if it works. And also yesterday we were talking about, at the end of the class, you know, is the practice of Tonglen done for others or for oneself? And I said that, you know, the way it's explained traditionally is it's done for oneself. It's a practice for bringing about a positive transformation of your own mind, to have more compassion and more love, more kindness, and to decrease selfishness, anger, and so on, the negative states of mind. So it's for your own mental development or spiritual development. And they say that, it's not impossible that it could have an effect on others. They do say that if you're doing Tonglen for somebody else, taking on the suffering of somebody else, it's possible, if you have a strong karmic connection with that other person, it's possible that that person's suffering might leave them and come into you. So there are stories like that. So it's not that it never happens. So it could happen. But it's unusual, it's rare. Most of the time, it doesn't happen. But then I remembered last night reading an article about Tonglen by a woman in America, and she would use it during business meetings. And she said it had an effect. Because she said in these business meetings, sometimes the atmosphere was sort of tense and people were not very nice to each other and so on. So it was kind of a negative atmosphere in the meeting. And after she learned the Tonglen practice, she would try it out. So she'd just sit there, because nobody has to know you're doing it. You're just doing it mentally in your mind. So she would sit there and imagine taking in all the negative energy in the room and sending out positive energy. And she said she noticed that it did have an effect, that people did seem to calm down and become nicer to each other and less sort of antagonistic and so on. So she noticed that herself, but it seems her colleagues noticed it as well, because she said one time she was walking down the hallway in one direction and she met these two men who were walking in the other direction, and when they saw her, they said, "Oh, aren't you coming to the meeting?" Apparently there was some meeting happening, but she wasn't going, or she didn't need to go. And she said, "No, I'm not going to that meeting." And they said, "Oh, that's too bad, because when you're there at the meetings, they seem to go better." So that means other people noticed that, her being there did have an effect. So it's worth trying, you know, at work, in meetings. And like I say, once you know how to do it, you can do it in a minute. And nobody has to know. You don't have to sit there like this and do it, you know. You can just, you know, just sit quietly at your desk, even have your eyes open, and just mentally, you know, imagine either the Tonglen that we just did, taking on your own suffering, or taking on the suffering of others and sending out positive energy. So it might make a difference. It might help. And even if it doesn't change others or change the external atmosphere, it will probably change your own internal atmosphere, your internal state of mind. And if you can be more calm and peaceful and positive, that probably will have an effect on others. Because another thing they find, the research done by scientists in America, they say that kindness is contagious. Kindness is contagious. So when one person does an act of kindness and other people see that or hear about that, they are inspired and motivated to also do an act of kindness. So you may have noticed that yourself if you ever saw somebody helping another person, right? Helping them, like an elderly person who's having difficulty walking, or somebody's trying to lift some heavy load, and you see somebody coming and helping them. And if you notice that, you might think, wow, what a nice thing to do. And then the next time you have an opportunity to do something like that, you will do it, right? So that's a really beautiful thing, because that means if one person does an act of kindness, other people see that, then you may have five other people doing an act of kindness because of the first one. And then when those five people do an act of kindness, again, another, you know, 25 people might do an act of kindness. So it spreads like that, a ripple effect. So in the end, you may have 100 or 200 or 1,000 people doing acts of kindness. Anyway, so that's one of the benefits of being kind and compassionate and helpful to others. Not only do we help that person, but we may also inspire others to act kindly, and then more and more people will benefit from that. Okay, so any questions so far? I'm going to try this again. Is it on the machine? See if it works today. Okay. So yesterday afternoon I started talking about this text called the 8 Verses of Thought Transformation or Mind Training. So this is a text from Tibet from about 1,000 years ago or so. And it's found in probably all the traditions of Tibetan Buddhism. It's well known, and the Dalai Lama teaches it quite often, and so do other lamas. And it's a fairly short text, so you can easily memorize it. And then you have the verses in your mind, and then you can, you know, remember them in certain circumstances, and they might help you to deal with difficult circumstances. Okay, so we talked about this one yesterday, and the basic idea here is seeing other beings as precious, and there's different reasons for that. One is just practical, you know, our food, our clothes, our coffee, our water, our house, our electricity, everything. Everything we use and enjoy in our life comes from others. There are other people who work to produce these things. So if everybody disappeared and we were all alone on this planet, we'd have a really hard time, right? And also we'd be very lonely, right? Human beings don't do very well alone unless, I mean, there's a few rare exceptions like Milarepa, yogis, meditators who can stay all alone, but that's rare. Most people are miserable when they're alone. That's why that's a punishment in prison, you know, to put a person in solitary confinement. It's like torture, right? So just the fact that, you know, we wouldn't be happy by ourselves. We need other people to be happy and to feel fulfilled and satisfied. Then others are precious, even more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. So the reason for that is because if we wish to achieve enlightenment, Buddhahood, we can't do it alone. It's impossible to achieve enlightenment all by ourselves. We need others to teach us. We need teachers to teach us how to practice. We need companions who practice along with us and give us support and help. But we also need others as the objects of our practice, to practice love, compassion, patience, ethics, generosity, and so on. So we can't develop those practices if we don't have others as our objects. And this will become more clear as we go through the other verses, why others are important, even the really nasty ones and difficult ones that we wish would disappear. But they, too, are precious. Okay, so let's see if I can move to the next one. Yay, it's working today. Okay, so verse number 2 says, whenever I am with others, I will practice seeing myself as the lowest of all, and from the very depth of my heart, should be heart, spelling boo-boo, out of depth of my heart, I will respectfully hold others as supreme. So this verse is about the importance of decreasing pride and arrogance and increasing humility. So when we first read this, we may feel a bit shocked, you know, the idea that I am the lowest of all, everybody's higher than me, better than me. And we need to be careful not to think that this means hating ourselves and thinking, we talked about that yesterday, you know, thinking I'm horrible, I'm the worst person in the world, I'm a loser, I'm a failure, everybody's up there and I'm way down here. So it's not that. That's not what's being talked about here, okay? That's a kind of mental disease to think I'm the worst person in the world, I'm lousy, I'm horrible, I hate myself. So that isn't what's being advocated here, okay? So don't think that. So instead, this is the opposite of pride or arrogance. So I prefer to use the word arrogance because sometimes pride is used in a way that isn't necessarily negative. For example, a parent taking pride in their child when the child does well in school or win some prize, you know, the parent will feel, oh, I'm so proud of you. So that's not necessarily what's being talked about here. Pride or arrogance, I'll use the word arrogance. Arrogance is where we feel superior to others and look down on them. I am smarter, I am better, I am more beautiful, I am richer, I am higher socially, or whatever. There can be all kinds of reasons for feeling arrogant, even in a spiritual context. You know, I'm a better meditator than you. I mean, we may not say that, but in our mind, you know, we might think that. I am more generous, I am more kind, I am more patient. So even when it comes to spiritual practice and spiritual qualities, we could take pride. You know, I have more knowledge, I have done more studies, I have finished the BP, and you haven't. I'm talking about the basic program, which is, I mean, it's wonderful, I'm not putting it down. You know, it's wonderful to do these study programs, but we just have to be really careful that that doesn't become a source of arrogance. I know more, I'm smarter than you. Because we do have this tendency, It's one of the primary delusions or mental afflictions that everybody has. And, you know, until we reach higher levels of mind. So we do have to look out for it. And if we do notice it, then we need to work on it. Because otherwise we're looking down on others, and that's not a nice attitude to have. Also, they say that pride or arrogance is a hindrance to spiritual growth. There's this wonderful analogy that I like. They say that having pride or arrogance is like being on the peak of a high mountain, and having humility is like being in the valley below. When the rain falls, it hits the top of the mountain, but it doesn't stay there. It just rolls down, and then it collects in the valley below. So on the top of the mountain, you don't find much growing. You don't find trees or plants or anything growing. It's barren, it's dry. But down in the valley below, it's very fertile. You have all kinds of things growing, nice trees and crops and vegetables and fruits and flowers and so on. So in a similar way, if we have this attitude in our mind of pride and arrogance, then even when it comes to listening to teachings given by, it could be a wonderful, fantastic, knowledgeable teacher, but we may be sitting there finding fault in the teacher, thinking, I know more than the teacher, you know? And that's really negative. And then your mind is closed. Your mind closes, and you can't learn anything. You can't grow. Whereas somebody who has humility, a humble state of mind, free of pride and arrogance, their mind is open. So then when the teachings come in, you know, then they're able to learn a lot and grow a lot and develop a lot. So that kind of shows how important it is to have humility. And they tell the story about this one Tibetan. He was the chief disciple of Lama Atisha. Lama Atisha was a great Indian master who went to Tibet and was very important in development of Buddhism in Tibet. And he had a number of Tibetan disciples. The main one was named Drumdanpa. And he was renowned for his humility. And he actually once said, you know, the only thing lower than me is the earth. So he didn't feel, even though he was actually a great meditator and very knowledgeable and a great teacher, he didn't take pride in that. He wasn't proud or arrogant, and he remained humble. And in fact, there's a story that I heard about him, because he wasn't a monk, he was a lay person. And so one day he was on his way to a place where he had been invited to teach. And he was walking. In Tibet, they didn't have automobiles, and so everybody had to walk. So he was walking towards this monastery, and along the way, he met this yogi. And then they were both going in the same direction, so they were walking together. And this yogi, it seems, was a bit proud, and he thought, you know, he was better than this simple man, this Drumdanpa, who looked very simple and ordinary. So after a while, the yogi said, you know, my pack is kind of heavy. Will you carry my pack for me, my backpack or knapsack or whatever? So Drumdanpa said, sure. So he took it on. And then the yogi said, could you carry my shoes? He had an extra pair of shoes. Could you carry those? So Drumdanpa agreed, you know. So he was carrying this other person's stuff. And they continued, and then they started getting closer to the monastery where Drumdanpa was meant to be teaching. And outside the monastery, there were all these people with katas and incense, you know, waiting for this great master to come. And the yogi said, oh, look, it looks like some, you know, they're waiting for some great master to come and teach. I wonder who that is. And Drumdanpa said, it's me. And the yogi was so embarrassed. He just grabbed his stuff and ran away. But I really like that story because it shows that Drumdanpa wasn't proud. You know, he didn't say, how dare you ask me to carry your things for you? Don't you know who I am? So this is what a proud person would do, an arrogant person. So he didn't. He was just very humble and said, sure, I'll carry your stuff. So it's nice to have stories like that of people who are humble and just to see how they behave. It gives us a kind of role model to follow. So if we do have pride or arrogance, what can we do about it? First I want to mention the difference between pride and arrogance, which is a negative state of mind, and self-esteem or self-confidence, which is not negative. So we need to differentiate those, because some people think that, you know, getting rid of pride, you also have to get rid of self-confidence and self-esteem. But that's not true. We actually need self-confidence to be able to progress along the path. We have to believe in ourselves. We have to believe that we have good qualities, we have potential. Because, I mean, especially in the Mahayana, what we're talking about is aspiring for enlightenment, Buddhahood. So you have to have tremendous self-confidence to think you can do that. I can become a Buddha. I can do what the Buddha did. Okay? So you need a lot of self-confidence and self-esteem. But that's not the same as arrogance. And the way I see the difference is, with arrogance or pride, we usually are comparing ourselves with others and feeling, I am better and they are worse. I am higher and they are lower. So it's a sense of kind of being superior to others. Whereas with self-esteem or self-confidence, we don't do that. We simply acknowledge that we have good qualities, we have abilities, and that we are doing good things. We're meditating and practicing ethics and at least trying, you know. We don't have to be perfect, but at least we're trying to do good things, and we do good things. So it's just a recognition or acknowledgement of the good things about ourselves, but we're not looking at others and, you know, comparing ourselves with others and thinking I'm better than they are, right? So we don't need to do that. Because in fact, according to Buddhism, everybody has the same basic good qualities. Everybody has love and kindness and compassion. Everybody has Buddha nature. Everybody has the potential to transform themselves. Everybody will be enlightened one day. So from that point of view, nobody's better than anybody else. We're all equal. Yeah. So is that clear, the difference between self-confidence, self-esteem, and pride or arrogance? So we do need self-esteem, self-confidence, to be able to feel, I can practice, I can change myself, I can improve myself, I can achieve these higher states of mind and eventually become a Buddha, I can help others. Okay, so we definitely need that kind of attitude. But not arrogance, not be proud and arrogant about it. So what I found helpful, because I have pride, I have arrogance, and what I find helpful to counteract that is to contemplate how I depend on others for whatever good qualities that I have. So for example, you know, people sometimes praise me as a teacher. Oh, you're such a good teacher. You've helped me so much. Or the books that I've written. Oh, that was so good. It helped me so much. So to avoid pride in that, I think to myself, well, whatever I teach and whatever I wrote in my books, I learned from my teachers. I wasn't born with that. It's not my natural knowledge and abilities, but it's because I met wonderful teachers and I learned from them and I practiced under their guidance. So it's only because of my teachers that I have this knowledge. Okay? So that helps me to avoid pride. So whatever it is we might take pride in, we might feel arrogant about, we can think about how this came from others or we were dependent on others. So even if you have let's say you're proud of your body, your attractiveness, your abilities, your talents. So where did all those things come from? Did you have all those things when you were born? Of course, we had our body when we were born. Maybe our body was naturally attractive from day one. But still, it came from our parents. Okay, so their genes. It's their genes that are responsible for this attractiveness. Also, from the Buddha's point of view, there's karma. Because even in the family, you know, you may have very attractive parents, but that doesn't mean all the children are necessarily attractive. So karma is another thing. And Buddhism says the cause of being attractive is patience. So the practice of patience, being patient in past lives, is the main cause for why we might be attractive in this lifetime. Okay, so then we can think about that and think, oh, well, I better make sure I continue to be patient in this lifetime, otherwise I might become ugly. So anyway, the point is, think about the causes and conditions and the other people from whom you acquired whatever it is that you may feel pride in. So that is a really helpful way to reduce pride and have more humility, recognizing our dependence on others. Another thing that's helpful is to remind yourself of the things that you're not good at. So you might be good at some things. Okay, so I can teach Buddhism and I can write, but I can't fix a car. You know, if a car breaks down, I'm hopeless. I can't even fix a flat tire. I can't fix my computer when it breaks down. You know, so there are people who are really good at those things, and I'm not. So that's helpful to cool down your pride. You know, you may be good at some things, but not at other things. Yeah? Remind yourself of the things that you don't know, the things that you can't do, and so on. And it's also helpful when feeling superior to others to focus on the good qualities of others. Because when we're feeling superior, we're maybe just focusing on certain things about them that we think are not good, things they're not good at or whatever. So that's not nice. That's being sort of critical and judgmental. So we can make a deliberate effort to remind ourselves of and think about good things about them. Everybody has some good things. So focusing on the good things that other people do, the good things that they have, good qualities they have, and so on, that also helps us to reduce this tendency to feel I'm superior, they are inferior. Yeah? Does that make... So I think the essence of this verse is just try to not feel superior to anybody, right? The Dalai Lama, there's some books in which he's explaining these verses, and he said, so he wonders, like with regard to an insect, how can I feel that I'm lower than an insect? That's a little challenging. So he says, well, in one sense, I can think that way because, I'm a human being, and as a human being, I have so much, like more intelligence and abilities and so on and so forth than an insect. An insect is, you know, very small and very limited in what they're able to do. But even though I have all this potential, I still don't always make use of it. I still... you know, sometimes waste my time, or I get angry, or, you know, I make mistakes. Whereas this little insect, even though it's, doesn't have so much ability and potential and so forth, maybe it doesn't make the same mistakes I do. I don't know, something like that. That's what he came up with as a way to feel that, you know, I'm even in relation to an insect, you know, I shouldn't feel that I'm superior. But you can use your own imagination and come up with ways in which you can avoid feeling superior and arrogant with respect to others. Also, I mean, even though, like, we all have the potential to reach enlightenment, we all have Buddha nature, okay, but when we reach enlightenment is very uncertain. Depends on so many different factors, so many causes and conditions. So it's possible that insect might reach enlightenment before me. I mean, as an insect, it can't do very much about reaching enlightenment. But maybe in its next lifetime, it will be born as a human being and will very quickly progress to enlightenment. But me, in my next lifetime, I might be born as an insect if I create bad karma and, you know, don't use my time well. So that insect might beat me to enlightenment. Who knows? It's possible, right? So it's just safer in general to avoid feeling superior, feeling better. Okay? Okay, next one. Number three. Okay, so this one says, in all actions, I will examine my mind, and the moment a disturbing attitude arises, endangering myself and others, I will firmly confront and avert it. So this is about the importance of mindfulness, practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness can mean different things, but one meaning, and this is probably the most well-known one, is just paying attention to what's happening in each moment, especially in your mind, especially observing what's going on in your mind. It's not easy to do, especially in our busy world and our busy life. There's so much going on around us, and we're rushing to, you know, fulfill our deadlines and get to meetings and so many things to do and so on. And so it's often the case that we're more attentive to what's going on outside of us and not so much what's going on inside of us. But that's a reason why it's really good to have a daily practice of meditation, if you can, especially first thing in the morning, even if it's just 10 minutes of meditation, just to have some time to sit quietly by yourself and observe your own mind, what's going on in my mind, what's happening in my mind. And the real purpose of doing that, observing our mind, is to be on the lookout for negative states of mind, anger, greed, selfishness, anxiety. So these disturbing emotions, troubling emotions, klesha. So we need to look out for those, because if they creep up in our mind and we don't do anything about them, then pretty soon they can take over our mind. And then they can motivate us to act out ways of unhelpful behavior, saying hurtful things, doing hurtful things, creating bad karma, and so on. So mindfulness is a practice. That's the main purpose of mindfulness, is to watch our mind. And when we do notice disturbing thoughts or emotions coming up, as soon as possible, do something about them so they don't get bigger and bigger and pretty soon they take over. And then it's like we're possessed. You know, people sometimes worry about being possessed by spirits, right? So I don't know if that's really true or not. But anyway, we can be possessed by our own delusions, by our own klesha, afflictions, possessed by our anger, possessed by our greed, possessed by our selfishness, and so on. So when we get possessed by our afflictive emotions, then the things that we do, the things that we say, can be quite destructive, harmful to others, and also to ourselves. We can harm ourselves. For example, if you're driving your car and you get really, really angry, maybe you're angry at another driver, even if it seems justified, they did something stupid. But if you yourself get angry and you're driving, the way you drive might be very dangerous, very hazardous. You could get into an accident. You would hurt yourself and hurt others as well. So, you know, lack of mindfulness can be harmful to your health, harmful to your life, as well as to others. So if you can recognize that danger, then you can see the importance of practicing mindfulness. And one analogy to mindfulness is that of a security guard in a bank or a jewelry store or a department store. So usually in a store where there's, or a bank where there's valuable things, money and, you know, jewels and so forth, they will, the store will employ somebody to be there, or many people, depending on how big the store is, and their job is to just stand there, walk around, watch people, and look out for trouble. That's their job, look out for troublemakers. And if they do see a troublemaker, to do something, not just to stand there and, you know, smoke a cigarette and drink coffee and let the troublemaker, you know, do their trouble. The person would get fired. They're not doing their job. So their job is to at least try to apprehend this troublemaker and stop them from creating trouble. So so that's the real job of mindfulness, is to look out for troublemakers that come into our mind and not just let them take over our mind and make a big mess, but to do something about them. So that's the meaning here. It says, in all actions, I will examine my mind, and the moment a disturbing attitude arises, endangering myself and others, I will firmly confront and avert it. So not letting disturbing attitudes like anger, greed, and so forth create havoc and problems for yourself and others. So this is actually not an easy thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to do. And in fact, it's like a lifetime job, watching our mind and working on our disturbing attitudes. And initially, when we first start to do this work, you know, we will probably be able to manage only with very strong or very gross forms of disturbing attitudes. But there's subtler ones that, you know, will take a lot more time to work on. So we have to be realistic. We have to understand that doing this is actually difficult to do, and it does take time, but, you know, we can at least start. And they say that we may have many disturbing attitudes or disturbing emotions, so it's best to start working on the biggest ones, the one that's the biggest, the worst, the most problematic for you. So let's say it's anger. Let's say you have a problem with anger, you get angry a lot. And anger is very destructive, so it's really good to try to work on that. So start with that one. Work on that one first. And maybe the other ones that are not so destructive you can deal with later, like pride or arrogance. Maybe that's not such a bad one. So work on the biggest ones, the worst ones first. And there's lots of different methods for working on anger. We don't have time to go into this here, but there's a number of books. For example, there's one by Venerable Chodron, Thupten Chodron, called Working with Anger. Have you seen that one? Yeah, it's all about how to work with anger. And I've heard there's one by Thich Nhat Hanh. I haven't read it. I think it's just called Anger. And another one by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, called Healing Anger. So there are quite a few books. And also, I'm sure, on the internet, if you Google, you know, how to work on anger, you'll get lots of material coming up. So it is good to look for methods, tools for working on anger, and then try them out. But it's also important to be realistic and understand that it does take time. You can't just like immediately stop having anger and immediately be patient all the time. But slowly, slowly, over time, you can reduce your anger. And actually, the practice of mindfulness itself is a very helpful way to reduce anger. I remember meeting a woman once who, she was the mother of a small child, and she had been meditating for about a year. And she said she just noticed, she wasn't even trying to be more patient and less angry, But she found that because she was meditating every day, she was more calm and not so likely to react with anger, which, you know, having a little child is plenty of opportunities to, especially when the child gets to be two and, you know, one and a half and running around, getting into everything and so on. So plenty of opportunities to get angry. But she noticed that, you know, things would happen that in the past she would have gotten angry, but now she was more patient, not so likely to get angry. So a regular practice of meditation itself is a helpful way to reduce anger. And I think impermanence helps too, just to get more familiar with how everything is impermanent. Our anger is impermanent, the situation we're getting angry about is impermanent, the other person is impermanent. So getting familiar with that, you know, that everything comes and goes and changes, nothing lasts, that can also be very helpful. Sometimes we get really angry because of something that's happening right now. But if we realize, well, you know, after an hour or two or the next day, you know, everything's going to be different and I'm going to feel different and everything will look different. Okay, so there's no need, no reason to get so angry, so upset about what's happening right now. So those are a few antidotes, and there's also other more specific antidotes. So it's said that the antidote for anger, the main antidote, is loving kindness, so, or metta in Pali. So if we make ourselves more familiar with that state of mind, which is done by just contemplating that others want to be happy just like me, just as I want to be happy, others want to be happy. Just as I don't want to suffer, others don't want to suffer. So becoming more familiar with that, we did a little bit of meditation on that yesterday, seeing others in that way. They're basically just like me, trying to be happy, trying to avoid suffering. So familiarity with that also helps us to reduce anger. It's also helpful just to see how harmful anger is, yeah, how destructive it is. Again, in the West, I've heard studies have been done, research has been done, and they've found that anger is harmful for our health. I even saw a book with the title, Anger Kills. So I know Chinese people like to be healthy and want to have a long life and so on. So we can recognize that anger is bad for us. It harms our health. It increases your blood pressure, your chances of heart disease. It will shorten your life and so on. So, yeah, that might be an incentive to try to be less angry and more patient. That's better for our health. Also for prosperity. Yeah, if you get angry a lot, you might lose friends, lose clients, lose your job, and then that would be disaster for your economic situation. So being kind and patient is... But then again, we also have to understand being kind and patient, that doesn't mean always being soft and sweet and letting people walk all over you. Okay, so this is a misunderstanding that people sometimes have. They even have, there's this expression, being like a carpet. I don't know if you use that here, being like a carpet or a doormat. You know, everybody can walk all over you and do whatever they want to you and you just sit there and take it. So some people think that's the meaning of being kind and patient, but that's not true. You can be kind and patient and still tough. And you need to be tough sometimes. For example, parents or teachers, if you're dealing with young children, you have to be tough. You have to be strong. You can't always say yes, 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 yes. You sometimes have to say no. Okay, but you can say no with kindness, with compassion. Okay, so it's the same at work, you know, dealing with your colleagues or your employees. You know, you can be tough and say, no, you can't do this, no, you have to do that. But you can still do it with a kind heart, with kindness and compassion. Okay? So that's the ideal. The ideal is tough on the outside, soft on the inside. You know, knowing when it's important to say no, to be strong, to be tough, to be firm, but doing that not with anger or hatred or the wish to harm, but with the wish to benefit. The wish to benefit yourself, others, your company, your family, the world, and so on. Not easy to do, but that's the ideal. That's the ideal thing. And I'm sure you know that, those of you who are parents, or even if you have younger siblings that you have to manage sometimes. Any questions about that? Any questions so far about anything I've said? My turn. Okay, so what you're saying is, in the previous verse, instead of seeing oneself as the lowest of all, what about just getting rid of any kind of comparison, anybody higher, anybody lower, and just seeing everyone as equal? Is that what it says? Yeah, that sounds quite reasonable. I mean, I didn't write this text, okay, so... I mean, better to take that up with the author of the text, but... No, because I have the same question too. Why not see us all as equal? As, you know, we all have the same, we all have certain things in common. We all want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. We all have Buddha nature. And we all deserve to be happy and not suffer and so on. So, I mean, I agree. It does make sense that way. But I think my understanding is the reason for writing that is just to give a strong blow to arrogance, and because we do have that tendency to feel superior. I know I do. And to counteract that. But again, that doesn't mean putting yourself down and, you know, seeing yourself as useless, as rubbish, as, you know, hating yourself and so on. So I think it's just a total lack of arrogance and a sense of superiority. But within that, I mean, I see His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. He seems to be someone who's very humble, completely without arrogance or pride, but he's still tough and strong and full of confidence, you know, to go into all kinds of different situations and meet with all kinds of people. You know, he's not at all shy. He's very powerful and self-confident, but at the same time, humble. And I don't think he puts anyone down or looks down on anyone. So I think that's the point. The point is not to put anyone down and feel at all superior. Tricky thing. I don't know. I'm not there yet, but I think that's the ideal. Okay. I'm moving a little fast because we're not yet halfway through. So let's go to the next one. Number 4. Oops. Okay. So the 4th verse. It says, whenever I meet a person of bad nature who is overwhelmed by negative energy and intense suffering, I will hold such a rare one dear. Uh-oh, I made a boo-boo there. It should say, I will hold such a rare one dear as if I had found a precious treasure. Sorry, there's a boo-boo there. Okay, so the last line should say, I will hold such a rare one dear as if I had found a precious treasure. Okay, so what this verse is about is with respect to difficult people, people who have bad nature. So that could be people who are involved in bad things like, you know, crime, drug dealers, smugglers, terrorists. Okay, so there's lots of people like that in the world. And even in your neighborhood where you live, even in your family, there may be people who are doing really negative things. So with respect to people like that, it says, we will hold them dear and as if they are a precious treasure. So this is, the way I see it, each of these verses gets progressively more difficult, more challenging. So the idea here, as I understand it, is, you know, when it comes to people who behave nicely, you know, who behave well, live ethically, they're nice, they're sweet, they're kind, they're gentle, they're generous. With people like that, it's relatively easy to feel love, compassion, patience, you know. They kind of bring out the good in us, so it's not too difficult, not too challenging to feel good towards them. But then when it comes to people like this, this is really difficult, really challenging to have the same degree of kindness, compassion, love, patience. And instead, we can find ourselves being very angry and hateful and having all kinds of negative thoughts, maybe even negative wishes. You know, I wish that person would just get blown up or disappear into a black hole in space or something like that, okay? So so I think that's the point here. The point is the ideal in Buddhism, both Mahayana and Theravada, is to be able to have love, kindness, compassion, you know, positive states of mind towards everybody, every living being, without exception. Even really difficult ones. In fact, there's this sutra in the Pali tradition. I don't remember the name, but it has a kind of nickname, the simile of the saw. Have you come across that one? So the Buddha is pretty extreme. The Buddha was talking to his disciples, and he said, even if you're grabbed by robbers and they tie you up, and then they start cutting you to pieces with a saw, you should have loving kindness and compassion for them. You never heard that one? Yeah? Wow. Pretty heavy. Okay, so this is in the Theravada tradition, in the Pali, it's not just Mahayana, okay? So, it's in the, I don't know about the Chinese tradition, but it's in the Pali Sutra, Pali canon. And so that means even if we are the recipient of horrible, cruel actions by somebody else, the Buddha said we need to maintain loving kindness and compassion. That's really, really difficult, right? But it just shows, you know, this is the Buddhist view. Yeah. So I think one reason for that is because anger, hatred, these are negative states of mind. They're very harmful, destructive states of mind. Even though they are natural, they naturally arise in us, but this state of mind is one of the reasons why we suffer. It's one of the things that keeps us in suffering, in samsara, dying and being reborn again and again and again, not achieving nirvana, not achieving enlightenment. So it's one of the factors that keeps us in suffering, keeps us from being free. So it's something we need to overcome if we do wish to achieve those higher states. Even if your goal is to achieve calm abiding, shamatha, you need to be able to manage your anger, because otherwise anger keeps popping up and taking your mind away. And so it's definitely a hindrance. Also, for if you know about these, the jhanas, these higher states of mind and higher levels of rebirth, the four jhanas and the four formless absorptions. So anger is a hindrance to achieving those as well. So even not talking about nirvana and enlightenment, even within samsara, it's a cause of suffering and a hindrance to achieving greater peace of mind and happiness. So that's one thing, the harmfulness of anger, the destructiveness of anger. But also, loving kindness, compassion, these are such positive qualities. These are qualities we need to develop to be able to achieve these higher states of mind. Even calm abiding, shamatha, the jhanas, much less nirvana and enlightenment. It's impossible to achieve those without developing very strong, powerful, loving kindness and compassion. So, if that makes sense, if you can see the importance of having positive states of mind and decreasing negative states of mind, then, you know, even in the case of very difficult people, people doing really bad things, we should strive to not become angry at them, not have hatred towards them, and instead have loving kindness and compassion towards them, and patience, practice of patience. So, like I say, it's not too difficult to have patience and kindness towards nice people. And then we might even become kind of complacent and think, well, I'm such a patient person, I have so much patience, I don't have much anger. Yeah, so you might even think that way. But then when you do meet or hear about some person who's doing awful things and, you know, anger explodes in your mind, well, that's actually a great lesson. That's a teaching. Oh, I'm not as patient as I thought. I do still have anger. So they actually say, there's this saying that the enemy is our greatest teacher. Enemy meaning, I mean, it could be someone who's actually trying to harm you, but it could also just be somebody who stirs up your anger. And they might be harming somebody else, or they might be doing awful things. You just hear about them and you get angry. So that person is actually a great teacher, teaching us patience, giving us an opportunity to increase our patience and decrease our anger. The way I see it is, you know, we do have patience. Everybody has a certain amount of patience, and we are able to be patient up to a certain point, but then we lose it. We fall into anger. Okay, so the ideal thing is to be able to extend that limit further and further and further, be able to remain patient longer and longer with more and more difficult people in difficult circumstances before we lose it and then get angry. You know, and eventually it's possible to get to the point where there's no more anger and you're able to be patient all the time in all circumstances. But it takes time, and we need to work. We need to make effort to be able to do that, to have stronger patience and less anger. So that means we need people to show us where we're at in our patience. And the enemy, the difficult person, gives us a chance to do that, to see, oh, I still have anger, I still need to work on my patience. Okay, so that's why it's said that this person is like a precious treasure. Yeah. Does that make sense? So how to do this when it does come to somebody like that, a person who challenges our patience? We find ourselves losing our patience and getting angry. So some things that we can contemplate would be, like we did yesterday, understanding this is another human being, just like me. They want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. So getting familiar with that contemplation is really helpful. Just like me, they want to be happy, they don't want to suffer. Also, Buddha nature. This person has Buddha nature too, just like me. One day they will become enlightened. Impermanence is really helpful too. Old friend impermanence, because negative qualities, negative behavior are impermanent. They're not permanent. And we can see that if we really carefully think about this person or observe this person, we'll probably notice that they're not always doing bad things. There are times when they're just normal, doing their job, and maybe times when they're even doing good things. Maybe that person is a parent, they have kids, they're looking after their kids, looking after their friends. So if we really think about it and really look carefully, we'll probably see that there are times when that person behaves nicely. So they do have good qualities. They are doing good things. Not always doing awful things. Okay. I'll share this story that I've found really helpful. You may have heard me talk about this before, but in case you haven't. Some years ago, during the time when George Bush was still the president, George Bush Jr., and he had started these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, and I was quite he was my enemy. I was really angry at him. I knew I shouldn't be angry, but I couldn't help it. I was just whenever I heard his name or saw his photo, I just get really angry. And so one time I was attending some teachings by the Dalai Lama. He was in Germany, and he knows quite a few world leaders. You know, he gets invited to the White House and to the European Parliament and here and there and so on. So he kind of rubs elbows with these people. And so sometimes during his teachings, he was teaching traditional Buddhist teachings, but sometimes he'd, talk about, politics and what was going on here and there. And so one time he started talking about George Bush. And he said, "I like George Bush." He said, "I don't like his politics, but I like him as a person. He's very down to earth." And I was sitting there just feeling astonished. Because I have so much respect for the Dalai Lama, And if he can see good things in George Bush, I thought, wow, there must be something good there. I don't think he's stupid or blind. There must be some good qualities for the Dalai Lama to say that. So that was really helpful for me, to look at my feelings, my anger, my aversion towards George Bush. And also, I realized, I don't even know George Bush. I've never met him, never been in the same room with him. All I know is what you read on the news and so on and so forth. So I had formed this opinion of George Bush just based on, a few facts that I've heard or things on the news and so on. Whereas the Dalai Lama has met him. He's met him. He's spent time with him. So he's in a much better position to know what kind of person he is than me. And so that really helped. And also, what he said was really helpful. He said, "I don't like his politics, but I like him as a person." Yeah? So that means there's, we sometimes think if we like somebody, we have to like everything about them. We either like everything or we dislike everything, all or nothing. Yeah? But that's not necessary. We can say, there's certain things about that person I don't like, I don't agree with. Yeah, I don't like what they're doing, I don't like this behavior or whatever. But other things I do like. Yeah? So that's really helpful to make this kind of separation. Certain things we do like, other things we don't like, certain things we agree with, other things we don't agree with. Yeah? So that's something we can do here as well. If there's a person we get angry at or we dislike, and it may be true, the person's doing horrible things. Maybe they're, you know, raping, torturing, committing terrorist acts, murdering. Okay, so we can say or think, I don't like that. I don't like what they're doing. I don't like the attitudes that are leading them to do that. But understand that that's not all there is. There's more to the person than that. Yeah, that, like I say, that person might be a parent and have children, and they may be very kind to their children, taking them to school, you know, making them lunch, and so on. So there's certain aspects of the person that are good, that are positive. So we can separate out the different aspects, different qualities, different behavior of the person, and it's fine to condemn some and say, I don't like that, but still recognize, acknowledge, and admire the good things about the person. So that's helpful to be able to do that. Does that make sense? Also with yourself, you might think about yourself. I mean, maybe there's some things about you that other people don't like, right? Certain habits that you have, certain behavior that you have, and other that really irritates other people. People can't stand it. But don't you feel, but, you know, there's other things about me that are good. Yeah, I agree with you that, you know, I have these bad habits and I make mistakes and so on, but I don't want you to only see that. I want you to see my good qualities too, good things that I'm doing, right? That's how we would like others to see us. Rather than, you know, we make one mistake and they say, oh, you're hopeless, you're a loser, you're terrible, you're bad. But wait a minute, you know, I do this and that and I'm good at this and that. Right? So we don't want other people to judge us only on our mistakes and our faults and our shortcomings. We'd like people to see our good side as well. Okay? So let's try to do that with other people too. See that they have some good qualities and appreciate the good qualities that they have and not only focus on the faults and the mistakes and condemn them for that. So that experience that I had with the Dalai Lama was very helpful. And from that time on, I really made an effort to stop hating George Bush. And think, okay, yeah, he's got a wife and he's got kids and a mother and a father, and you know, he's probably a really nice person with them and with his friends as well. But you know, I can still disagree with his starting this war and that war and so on and so forth, but still appreciate the other good qualities. And then a few years ago, I was talking with a friend of mine who also used to have a big problem with George Bush. And she said she was watching TV one night, and one of these talk shows, you know, they have a host, and then they invite different guests, and they talk. And so there was this talk show, and George Bush came to this talk show, and he brought with him a painting that he had made of the talk show host, a portrait. And he gave it, he offered it to the host. And my friend said, he's really good. He's a good painter. And that's something I'd never heard about before. But it seems that after he, you know, stopped being president, he had more free time, he started painting, something he really liked to do. And so he's painted all these pictures. So I went online and looked at pictures on Google. You can Google in George Bush's paintings, and you can see all these paintings he's made. Many of them are portraits, including a portrait of the Dalai Lama. I thought, wow, he actually took the time to paint a portrait of the Dalai Lama. I mean, that shows something. And there was one painting that really touched me. It really changed my mind. It was a painting of his little white dog. this cute, fluffy white dog. And he was in the picture. He was standing next to this painting with his big smile on his face, like a little kid, you know, who's showing his mommy, "Look, mommy, look what I did." And I thought, wow, he can't be such a bad person. So, yeah, it really helped to soften my mind. And then I think it was last year, his mother died. George Bush's mother died. And I really felt sad for him. I really, really felt, oh, you know, that must be really painful. And, you know, if I had the chance, I would send my condolences. I'm sure it wouldn't matter to him. But, you know, I really felt, you know, I'm sorry for you to lose your mother. That must have been very painful. So I could see how my mind has changed towards that person who used to stir up so much anger in me. So it shows that, you know, if we work on it slowly, slowly, we can reduce anger even towards people who do things that we find really bad and really wrong, and even feel a softness towards them. And one thing I find helpful too, this is helpful for me, is to think about the Buddhas and how the Buddhas look at us. You know, imagine the Buddha. I mean, Buddha's everywhere, but just imagine a Buddha up there, you know, looking down on us, looking down on this world and all of us, and seeing that, you know, all of us are doing crazy things. All of us are making mistakes and having bad thoughts and saying bad things and doing bad things. But the Buddha doesn't get angry at us. The Buddha doesn't judge us. The Buddha understands, well, we're just ordinary sentient beings in samsara, and we don't have total control of our mind, and we have all these bad things coming up in our mind, and we're doing the best we can, but sometimes our mind is just out of control. And Buddha can also see we have a lot of good qualities too. Everybody has some good qualities. Everybody has some compassion and kindness and patience, and one day, you know, we're going to be all cleaned up and enlightened, just like him. So he's able to see that. So he doesn't feel anger or hatred or, you know, reject anybody. He's able to have compassion, forgiveness, and continue wanting to help us. So when I think of that, and I try to think of how the Buddha sees everybody and how the Buddha sees my enemies and people like George Bush and the current president and all the terrorists and so on and so forth, it does help me to, you know, imagine, or at least imagine, that there is another way of thinking, another way of seeing everybody. Yeah. So maybe I've done enough talking for now, and we have a little bit of time left. How about we do some meditation? So get into a comfortable position, trying to keep your back straight. Even if you're feeling tired, we've been sitting here almost 2 hours now. But sitting up straight can actually help to sort of lift up your energy, wake up your energy, give you more energy. And for a few moments, go back to your breathing, be aware of your breath flowing in, flowing out. So that can help you to settle down in case your mind is busy thinking of things, maybe plans for what you're going to do during the break. And just put aside all other thoughts and just come back to the present, right here, right now. So now think of a person that you find difficult. If you never tried this before, you might try thinking of someone towards whom you have just mild levels of anger or irritation rather than your worst enemy. If there's someone who has done horrible things to you, caused you a lot of suffering, or caused a lot of suffering to people you care about, it might be too challenging to think of that person. So instead, think of someone who is just mildly annoying or irritating. And first of all, just look at that attitude in yourself, that feeling of dislike or aversion or anger or hatred, and ask yourself, is this a positive state of mind? Is it a good state of mind? Is it one that I would like to perpetuate? Or can you see that it's actually disturbing and unpleasant? Something that you would prefer not to have. So it is possible to work on our mind and change our mind. We don't have to just get stuck with negative feelings. So let's think about a few ways that we could work on this feeling of anger or irritation and how to reduce that and increase more positive feelings towards the other person. So one is to just try to see the other person as someone basically like yourself, a person who wants to be happy, doesn't want to be unhappy. This is also a person who, like you, is in samsara, in cyclic existence, unenlightened existence, which means within their mind there are these disturbing emotions, ignorance, greed, anger, selfishness, pride, and they probably don't know how to manage these states of mind, and instead they come up very strongly and take over, and the person is kind of possessed by these negative states of mind and acting under their control. And that means that they're not actually happy. Their mind isn't calm and happy and peaceful, but is disturbed, troubled, unhappy. So in fact, they're suffering. And if they're doing harmful things, that means they're creating negative karma, bad karma. And if they don't purify that karma, then they will suffer even more in the future when that karma ripens. So So that might enable you to feel some compassion for the person rather than anger or hatred. It might also be helpful to think that the person probably isn't 100% bad all the time. They probably have some good qualities and at certain times act out those good qualities and do helpful things, at least to their own family and friends. And then according to Buddhism, every person has Buddha nature, a pure, positive nature and qualities. And eventually, one day, everyone will reach the state of Buddhahood or enlightenment, free of all the negative qualities, fully developed in all the positive qualities. And it might be helpful to try to imagine how a Buddha would see this person, how this person appears in the eyes or the mind of a Buddha. Because a Buddha has no anger, no hatred, no aversion, only kindness, compassion, forgiveness, but also wisdom. A Buddha is able to see this person's real nature and the fact that they're not always going to be the way they are now. But one day, they will be a Buddha too. They will be fully enlightened. So, for many of us, just thinking about these ideas may not work right away. We might need to think about them, contemplate them again and again. But I think probably, eventually, if we put effort into it and keep thinking about these, then we'll probably notice that our mind does change, does soften. And our anger and hatred will be less strong, and gradually we'll feel more positive attitudes towards the other person. So it does take time, but it's worth it. Because if you can have more positive attitudes towards others, you will feel better. It's better for your mind and also your health. Remember, anger is bad for us. Also, I'll just share with you one last thing. I heard this from Jetsunma Tenzin Palmo, a wonderful English nun teacher. I think she's been to Singapore quite a few times, so maybe you may have had a chance to get teachings from her. So I can remember how she said it. She said, it makes complete sense to have loving kindness towards a bad person instead of anger. Because anger, when we have anger, the feeling of anger is we want that person to suffer, right? We want that person to suffer. So this person that we are angry at is probably already suffering a lot. And that's why they're behaving that way. Right? When people are happy and peaceful, they usually behave quite nicely. So when a person is behaving badly, it's most probably because they're not happy. They're suffering. Okay? So if we have anger at them, that means we want them to suffer even more than they already are. And if they suffer even more than they are, then they'll be even worse. They'll do even more negative things, right? On the other hand, if we can have loving kindness and compassion, that means we want them to be happy. We want them to be free of suffering. And if they could be more happy and more free of suffering, they'd probably be a nicer person. They probably would behave in a nicer way, not such a horrible way. And then it would be easier to like them. That makes sense? So logically, it makes more sense to have kindness and compassion rather than anger and hatred. It will bring about the kind of change that would be better for everybody. Right? So I found that very interesting, very intelligent too. Right? So even if it's hard to do, but if we make an effort, we try. I wish that person could be happy. I wish that person could be free of suffering. Because if they could be happy, they could be free of suffering, they wouldn't be so annoying. They wouldn't be so irritating. So that's something to think about. I'll leave you with that for now. So we'll have our break now for lunch. And meet again at 1:30. And we'll still have meditation at 1:30, 1:30 to 2 with Wai Chong. And then I'll come back at 2 and we'll finish looking at the 8 verses. And I understand the Buddhist Library is having their annual fun fair over over at the tent near. So you might consider, you know, supporting their efforts, because they do such a wonderful thing. You know, they bring so many Dharma teachers and have this wonderful library where you can borrow books and so on. So good to support them. Okay. Oh yeah, let's just take a moment to dedicate the positive energy we've created this morning. Feel good about what we've done, spending the time listening, thinking, meditating on these teachings about how to make our mind more positive and less negative. So we've created some good energy, merit, and now we can share that merit with others, wishing that it will bring benefit to them, help them have more compassion, love, wisdom, good qualities, and less anger, greed, selfishness, negative qualities. May it help us all get closer to peace, to liberation, to enlightenment. Okay, so enjoy your lunch break. We'll see you later.